from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting but not video streaming live from our studios through New York City. I'd like to welcome all of you all over the world. Today, we're going to take a look at reimagining Western civilization that respects the wisdom of nature. My guest will be the founder and co-CEO of Bioneers, a network of visionary scholars, scientists, and social leaders dedicated to understanding how nature and living systems operate to find sustainable solutions to support human life while living in harmony with nature. He's an award-winning journalist and filmmaker who has pioneered ideas in preserving biodiversity, organic farming, and food production alternative medicine. And he also did the film Hoxie, When Healing Became a Crime. So we're looking forward to having him on, Kenny Ajabel. Now also today, I'm going to share a piece of a film on those who find it no longer believable that the science of public health advocating vaccines, that they're safe and effective, should just be accepted without challenge. Now, though you won't be able to see the video, you can hear them, and you're going to hear a lot of physicians and scientists in this clip I'm going to play for you. Also today, from SD Wise Natural News, the true history of the American Medical Association. It was built on racketeering and the pocketing of nonprofit profits. It has a really sordid history, and he gives a short but accurate and concise history of the AMA. Now, having taken on the AMA, having debated the head of the AMA, having the chairman of the AMA attack me in a letter, and then I just completely deconstructed his illogical approach in response in a national publication where I had just inaugurated a series, the first of its kind in American history, 58 cover stories. That's never been done before since, on the politics of medicine, including beginning with one that really hard-hitting, medical genocide. And then I went into what the AMA was, what it had done, and in fact, a two-part series helped with the entire cause of chiropractic. And I showed the criminal activity of the AMA, and they were found guilty, and that guilt was upheld to the Supreme Court. So how is it that an organization that has no basis in science and nothing to do with helping the public and has the most sordid background, how does it still maintain its respect? We'll deal with that. Then today, I'm going to do one single issue, but from multiple perspectives. How your privacy has virtually become extinct in just the last decade. And why is our government collecting your biometric data? Did you know that? And also, six government surveillance programs designed to watch you all the time, 24/7. Do you know that our government actually has, right now, a laser that you will not know is being put on you that can detect what you ate, everything about your biochemistry? Everything. Why? Who gave him permission to do this? And yet, do you hear anyone complaining about it? Maybe we shouldn't complain about it. Maybe we should just accept that the government has complete and total control over our entire existence, as long as it's being done, of course, with the full cooperation and direction of those who make a profit from it, from corporate America. So in the end, are we all just nothing more than subjects, like serfs of corporate fiefdoms, and these fools that we call politicians? They're merely there to pimp for the corporate interest. And what would it be like if we only ask one thing, just one? They can take our kids and give them diagnoses that don't exist. They can implant tiny little metric seeds in them so that they can be monitored everywhere they go in life. They will be forced to take every drug, every additive, every bad food, and you cannot resist. Everything will be genetically engineered. You cannot protest. You cannot even think a negative thought. And we accept all that because we haven't protested it. So I'm assuming most people think it, you know, as long as you keep us entertained, distracted, we'll accept it. You don't see us helping anyone. You don't see us helping our neighbors who are losing their homes. If 100 million people can get smacked down, kicked in the teeth, battered and beaten by this president, his administration, and its Congress, and its corporate leaders, and its media, all complicit, then who are we to complain? Maybe it's the right thing to do. But why don't we just ask one tiny little thing in return, that everyone involved in this process of facilitating the complete destruction of all of our rights and liberties, wear a nice 1970s pimp outfit. How about that? And they have to drive pimp mobiles. So at least we could know who they are when we're walking down the street or they come on television. That's the only concession. You think? I'll deal with these punks. Who am I talking about? I don't think I have to explain. Just about everyone in authority is a punk to me. So there's going to be a little beat down of punkism today on this show. Let's begin. For a long time, official medicine refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of any therapy except what was patented and profitable and came from America. In effect, we were telling the world, whether it was German scientists or physicians or French or Israeli or any of the other societies, your science doesn't count. Your medicine cannot be accepted. And that was the official policy of our National Institutes of Health and our FDA. So if you had a therapy that was used and proven effective and safe in Italy by its scientists and physicians and its government, you could not accept that in the United States because it hadn't been proven here. I remember at the time when James Reston came back from the trip to China and he had had some form of a medical emergency. I think it was an appendicitis. But in any case, he had had acupuncture that helped relieve the inflammation and the pain, and it worked, and he wrote about it. Now, he was an opinion leader because he was reporting for an official paper that became a policy wonk paper, the New York Times. Now, everyone else that ever spoke about acupuncture or their experience with it were considered anecdotal and not credible. That suddenly, if you're a writer and a respected writer for a respected paper, then suddenly, oh, gee whiz, this is just brand new information. At that time, there were already 2,000 studies published in the peer-reviewed literature around the world on the benefits and science of acupuncture. Still, it took decades before any physicians would accept that acupuncture was legitimate. They thought it was no better than the bush medicines out of Africa. That's how they equated it. The amount of bias, racism in medicine was just almost unconscionable. Here's the latest from Science Daily, published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. They did a review of 29 randomized controlled trials on acupuncture and pain and versus a placebo, what they call sham acupuncture. Quote, acupuncture is better than no acupuncture and is better than the sham acupuncture for chronic pain. So the good news is that finally, after reviewing 17,922 patients, they found it works. So now that it's officially accepted, even though it's been acknowledged, there are classes taught in it, you can get advanced credit for it, you can be certified in it, now it's official. It only took 50 years of denial before it was finally officially accepted. One of the reasons that I am working on this film every day to get it done in the next 5 weeks on genetic engineering is because I'm concerned about what happens when the public, that know it, the vast majority of Americans don't care what they eat, eat everything wrong to begin with, and they're not going to change. But for those who do care, 10 to 15%, that's still a lot of people. We don't want genetically engineered ingredients because there's been no safety studies to prove in humans that we won't end up one day having alterations to our own genes. They say it's not possible, and they are right. They've never looked. I say it's possible, and in the film I prove it by interviewing in France, India, England, and Canada, those scientists who've actually done the research and show that taking into your body something that's been genetically engineered can impact your own DNA. So we're both right. And that's the phenomena of the state of science today. You won't know if the science that you're being reported on is proprietary science, in which case it, in all likelihood, would be extremely biased or worthless, rather just independent, legitimate science, which could be important and allow us to know a truth we would not otherwise have known. Here's the latest on why you should be concerned. This is from Sayer G. from GreenMedInfo. Dow Chemical brings back an Agent Orange ingredient for new GM plants. I'll quote this. Whether you're aware of it or not, your food, air, and water are the battleground upon which a titanic struggle between the multinational biotech corporations, Monsanto and Dow AgriSciences, is now playing out. As a result, your health and environment, and that of all future generations, are at profound risk of irreparable harm. Dow AgriSciences, a subsidiary of Dow Chemicals, recently announced their development of genetically engineered corn, soybean, and cotton plants metabolically resistant to the herbicide 2,4-D, a major ingredient in Agent Orange. What this means for our future is that if approved for use, vast regions of our country will soon be sprayed with a chemical that has been linked to over 400,000 birth defects in Vietnam. How do we end up here? History is repeating itself before our eyes. Dow Chemical and Monsanto joined at the karmic hip. Both manufactured Agent Orange for use in Vietnam, and both are notorious for minimizing the adverse health effects associated with exposure to the agent. Neither corporation learned from its mistakes, largely because the U.S. government underwrote the risk of using the chemical and therefore shielded them from the bulk of the legal and financial fallout. But this lack of culpability has now set up the conditions for a reliving of the horrors of systemic herbicide exposure, only this time it's not Vietnam in the jungles, it's on American soil, with Monsanto choosing glyphosate and also a birth defect causing chemical, and Dow sticking to its old time favorite. The two corporations are now pitched in a heated battle for dominance as Monsanto's once global power over genetically engineered stable crops like soy and corn began to falter in the following four ways. One, Roundup resistance, which was bioengineered into food crops, began spreading to a number of other plants like weeds, rendering Roundup ineffective or requiring much higher and therefore much more toxic quantities. Two, insects began to develop resistance to Monsanto's BT gene, which was engineered into their plants as a insecticide, conferring resistance to BT-sensitive pest. Three, research on glyphosate, the major active ingredient in Roundup, has been used at the rate of 80,000 tons in the U.S. alone. And there are dozens of serious adverse health effects. And fourth, glyphosate was found to contaminate our air, water, and groundwater. Given these fatal flaws, Monsanto's once armor Dow AgroScience is positioning its new GE plants as the next generation solution to the problems of glyphosate and TPBT resistance. However, by engineering what amounts to Agent Orange resistance into their new and improved crops, the potential environmental health fallout to exposed areas is nothing less than horrific. Do we need to view pictures of the victims of Agent Orange to be reminded of how toxic the ingredients in this herbicide was? Instead of learning from Monsanto's colossal mistakes, Dow AgroScience's solution is to multiply the problem by a factor of three, creating the first ever three-gene herbicide-tolerant stable crops. What this means is that instead of using only one highly toxic herbicide, Roundup, three will be used simultaneously, further increasing the risk of serious exposure and setting up the conditions for synergistic toxicities, something that toxicological risk assessments on singular herbicide ingredients have never accounted for. So that's the latest. And there's an article on this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And by the way, Dow, when they, researchers from the National Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, reviewed Dow Chemical's own published research on 2,4-D resistant crops, it found highly misleading and inaccurate information. One more reason why we should speak out against genetically engineered crops. And in all 50 states, right now it's only California, we should get referendums on the ballots to say we want genetically engineered foods labeled. That is something we can do. We're doing it in California now, and the documentary will be shown all over California. I'll be going out to California to go city to city. We've already asked for, if I'm able, in other words, I am going to debate everyone that they can throw at me. I've asked for debates. I said, bring on the leading scientists who are pro genetically engineered materials. I will debate them. And then I'll be showing the documentary all over to show you what corruption, what malfeasance, what insanity genetic engineering is. And if you think I'm not prepared for these debates, you'd be mistaken. Watch any of the debates when they happen and see what I do with their arguments, where the idiots they have on television that interviews them in their multi-million dollar campaign to kill this legislation will not ask them any hard questions. It will be no small measure if we win, because if we win in California, then we can win in any state. Just say no to all, everything GMO. Separately, on the issue of something we can do that's good for ourselves, we can just start to like some foods that historically we haven't liked, and that's the cruciferous vegetables. People don't eat the cruciferous vegetables, but they should, because it can help prevent cancer. It can do a lot of good. Let me just give one example, and just a short example, broccoli. Organic broccoli can help give your liver needed support. It's loaded with essential nutrients, and it also helps prevent cancer. And the reason why is because it's a great source of cancer-fighting chemicals known as glucosinolates. And these go into the body and are transformed into powerful metabolites such as indole-3-carbinol or isothiocyanates, including sulforaphane. Now these chemicals, these phytochemicals, protect you from colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, thyroid cancer, cervical cancer. So just having broccoli, and even juicing broccoli, I would use celery and cucumber and apple, but I put a whole head of broccoli in there. It's rich in enzymes. It inhibits tumor cell adhesion. It helps prevent tumors from metastasizing. There's lots of science on this. And there's what is called PEITC, These are the phenethyl isothiocyanates, and they directly stop tumor's ability to supply itself with blood. This interruption of angiogenesis is considered crucial to fighting the cancer, because if the cancer doesn't get a blood supply, it dies, and this blocks that. Now, there's another chemical group in broccoli called sulforaphane, and that induces cancer cells to commit cellular suicide. And then you have indole-3 carbonyl, or its condensation product, 3,3, or DIM. And that interrupts the cancer cell's ability to reproduce. So if nothing else, make sure that you're getting your cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, each day. And something else you can get at this time that would be good for you is vitamin D. If you can't get outside in the sun for a half hour a day, then at least take vitamin E or vitamin D as a supplement. The latest shows that a lot of overweight people are not exercising. If you take 4,000 international units of vitamin D, as people in this study did, published in Clinical Nutrition and done at Purdue University for 12 weeks, and then you do resistance training, you can significantly decrease your waist-to-hip ratio of fat, and you can also increase your muscle power. So one more reason to take vitamin D and exercise. And finally, there's so many herbs and flowers that are important to our overall health. And one that we never hear about are lilies. And lilies are a hairless perennial herb and kind of whitish with scaly bulbs. You find a lot of them. The species is actually native to Canada, but you can find it any place where people are choosing to cultivate it. And now they're finding that there's a lot of medicinal value in it, and it was used by the Native American peoples. They were generally cooked and eaten with other foods, and the bulbs have a strong, bitter, peppery flavor. And it was used in thickening agents for stews. And some tribes also ate lily bulbs fresh or dried. And historically, lily bulbs are boiled in 2 changes of water, steamed in fire pits. But now they're able to take the medicinal value right out of them and make them into tinctures and teas. And they've been used now to treat stomach disorders, coughs, tuberculosis, fevers, help women in labor. And they can help as a wash with swellings, bruises, wounds, and sores. So lily bulbs also were used in helping people who had nausea. So just one more herb that we never hear about as far as its medicinal value, but it does have medicinal value. Now to an issue part of our program. I'm concerned that the most powerful medical organization in the United States has had a long and bitter, acrimonious position against everything that's natural healing. I've taken them on. I debated the head of the AMA and on network television out of Chicago. I've written about them and presented information to the chiropractors who sued them, and wrote 2 formidable articles, which are up on my website, in 1980, I think it was 1984, 1985. In any case, here is a short piece from S.D. Wells, Natural News. It says, the year was 1847. Physicians in America are not enjoying competing with inexpensive natural remedies, which are offered by Indians and skilled midwives. These are remedies which are very effective, but are not profitable, nor are they patentable. So the physicians get together to form an alliance called the AMA, the American Medical Association. And their purpose was to only have regulars allowed to join this new prestigious organization, which strictly excluded herbalists, homeopaths, and Native American healers. The new bylaws enacted would ensure that any physician caught dealing with a non-regular would be cast out and his reputation ruined. There was only one problem, and it was a huge problem. Conventional medicine in America was based upon philosophy, not science, because nothing had been tested. We know this is as a cold, hard fact today. The kind of medicine regarded as conventional or orthodox then consisted of bloodletting, mercury poisoning, and other methodological therapies that we would laugh at today. So words started getting out. Doctors from Europe who visited and then returned home told others of the ill health of the average American, whose skin was sallow, eyes sunken, teeth and jaws crooked. And lo and behold, these were all symptoms of mercury poisoning. And so there you have it. The United States healthcare system started with mercury poisoning. That was the foundation. That's why it's still in vaccines and flu shots, because they can't get away with it unless they make us believe that it's always been there and always safe. Then there was the year the AMA hired thugs. In 1905, Collier's magazine published an expose on the, quote, patentable remedy industry in a series of articles called The Great American Fraud. But by then, it was too late to stop the tsunami of criminal conspiracy that was crashing in on natural medicine. The AMA had created the Department of Investigation to hunt down doctors still using natural remedies. The department's sole job was to shut down any healers who could threaten AMA profits. The AMA thug department actually kept files on anyone who was cured of cancer. They also kept files on health foods, vitamins, acupuncture, any form of healing. The head of the AMA, one Morris Fishbein, was a criminal and an extortionist, and if you didn't pay him large sums of money for the AMA seal of acceptance, you simply could not survive in the medical field. Fishbein was the ultimate scam artist. The AMA never even had any facilities to test any of the drugs on which they put their seal of acceptance anyway. So it was all a huge scam. Jump forward to 2001. April 2001, three state medical societies joined together with over 75,000 members and sued the nation's largest health insurers. 12 different health plans and their so-called managed care authorities were violating federal racketeering laws. 20 individual doctors from seven states accused managed care companies of denying medically necessary treatments, systematically delaying payments, and bundling claims. By the way, bundling means they were making piles of claims they didn't want to pay on and denying them without review, all to keep money from physicians so the company could profit. The end result, the HMO's insurers' managed care practices had violated the Federal Racketeering Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. The HMOs automatically downcoded and bundled claims, which was done with software which had protocols set by the American Medical Association itself well in advance. This enabled the mass manipulation of reimbursements. The conviction marked the third time that the AMA was found guilty of antitrust violations for conspiracy. The AMA, again, guilty of racketeering three times. In America, we call it repeat offender, and usually three strikes and you're out. But corporations and federal commissions and regulatory agencies and politicians simply pay fines and settle out of court or get pardoned. The American people, for the most part, are so oblivious to medical corruption that even when the big cats do get busted red-handed for quackery and racketeering, they still go right back to the same doctors for magic pills, surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, believing there's some miracle cure for their bad diet and learned helplessness. The racketeer is a person who commits crimes like those of extortion, bribery, or loan sharking. Yet to most Americans, the concept of non-profit goes hand in hand with trust. After all, if an organization isn't driving itself towards the money wagon, they must be trustworthy. This is where false advertising takes over. The AMA is a nonprofit agency which gladly accepted huge sums of advertising fees from tobacco companies who advertise heavily in the Journal of the American Medical Association throughout the 20th century. After scientific proof positive came in about the dangers of smoking and the development of lung cancer, the AMA still ran the ads that quoted doctors talking about smoking, their favorite brands, and other ads claiming Camels were good for digestion. The AMA paid salaries and expenses for a team of medical doctors and lawyers to covertly destroy the entire chiropractic profession in the United States. And this is not some conspiracy theory or accusation. In 1990, four chiropractors won a landmark antitrust lawsuit where the court ruled that the AMA had violated the Sherman Antitrust Act and restraint of trade. According to a 1998 article in the New York Times, the AMA paid Sunbeam Corporation nearly $10 million to avoid a breach of contract trial. The AMA was going to endorse Sunbeam's blood pressure monitors without any plans to test them. The AMA only pulled out of the plan once the public knew. This is simply deja vu of Fishbein's fake seal of acceptance. Though huge lie was settled out of court, also in 1955 by the AMA, just like the Sunbeam lawsuit. After the case, the AMA said it was, quote, now fully focused on its historic mission to serve America's patients and the quality of American medicine, end quote. So, what was your mission before you were found guilty? To make money and to lie. Cancer attacks every other man and every third woman in the United States. There's a 50% survival rate. You need a plan? Who are you going to trust if you get cancer? Would you trust the huge pharmaceutical companies that run Western medicine? Who? Would you trust the AMA, the FDA, the National Cancer Institute? Organizations whose administrators and heads bounce back and forth from big pharma CEO jobs to running the government rackets that regulate food and medicine safety? The infamous AMA seal of approval is exactly the same situations we have today with the FDA, where approval of pharmaceutical drugs requires millions of dollars up front, but no real testing is done. And the heads of the FDA are former presidents or vice presidents of pharmaceutical and chemical companies that engineer and market these same untested, dangerous synthetic drugs. Then when the FDA gets caught, they simply give the victim's family a couple million and shut up. For those inclined to place trust in the AMA, just take a look at the association's history. Even today, the AMA continues to make decisions obviously designed to protect organized medicine, not patients. So what's the moral of the whole story? Since World War II, Americans have been falsely reaffirmed by the FDA, the AMA, and the National Cancer Institute that conventional medicine is based on science. Wrong. It's all a big lie. And that's his comments. Now, we're going to take a break and come back and go to our guest, who is standing by. And then after that, in our talkback segment, you'll have a chance to share your points of view, and then I'm going to get with the idea of we have no privacy, and we do not have an American public who seems concerned about it. Why? Why aren't they concerned? I'm Gary Nall. Please stay with us. It's time for our guest, and from New Mexico, let's say hello to Ken Ausubel. He is the founder and co-CEO of Bioneers, a network of visionary scholars and scientists and social leaders dedicated to understanding how nature and living systems operate to find sustainable solutions to support human life while living in harmony with nature. He's also an award-winning journalist and a filmmaker, and he has pioneered ideas in preserving biodiversity and organic farming, and he is the co-founder of Seeds of Change. Many of you know that company. It's an organic seed company. And his documentary film, Hoxie, When Healing Became a Crime, influenced national policy on alternative medicine. His most recent book is Dreaming the Future, Reimagining Civilization in an Age of Nature. And Bioneers Radio broadcast can be heard on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Nice to have you with us today, Kenny.
Hey, Gary, pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. Kenny, much of your work over the past couple of decades, and a large part of the Bioneer strategy and agenda, is to explore ways that nature can guide us in our innovations and social structures and energy projects that are sustainable and that do not conflict or destroy the natural resources upon which we depend. And this is a certain kind of science, as it were, known as biomimicry. How can we mimic nature's own operating instructions? And so introduce this idea further to us and provide us with some of the more exciting examples of inventions that have emerged from exploring this more holistic operating system intrinsic to the natural process around us.
Yeah, you know, it's incredibly interesting to me, Gary, because we go back to the days when I made the Hoxie movie, When Healing Becomes a Crime, which is all about cancer and just what you were talking about earlier. And as I delved really deeply into that world to understand, you know, beyond the obvious conflict of, you know, essentially an economic motive behind a lot of that world, there was also a deeper philosophical conflict between natural medicine and allopathic medicine. And the allopathic tradition really comes out of something called heroic medicine, the idea that the body has no ability to cure itself, and the physician has to the healer has to intervene with highly aggressive, often toxic or, you know, deadly interventions in order to make you get well if you don't die first from the treatments. And on the other hand, the natural medicine tradition says that the body has a profound ability for self-repair, for healing, that we don't really understand very well, and in fact we may never understand because it's so incredibly complex. So the role becomes to understand, you know, how to support the body to heal itself in many ways, obviously using not lethal and, you know, toxic interventions, except in rare cases. And that became really the underlying concept behind Bioneers, that nature has this profound ability for healing, and in a sense, our job is to understand how nature heals and then to support those processes. And that's really the origin of this idea of biomimicry, that nature has done everything we want to do without, you know, mortgaging the future or, you know, and so, you know, one really interesting example of that is that nature's favorite form is the spiral, from how blood moves in your veins and your lungs to literally the shape of galaxies. It's the Fibonacci sequence. It's the golden mean. It's the aesthetic, you know, sort of model of perfection and infinity in nature. From hurricanes, you know, the shape, you look at a hurricane or how water goes down your bathtub drain, it's a spiral. So this guy, Jay Harman, who grew up in Australia, lived by the ocean and started to observe this pattern throughout nature, and he realized that, in fact, it is not used in our design systems at all. You know, we basically use the heat, beat, and treat. If brute force doesn't work, you haven't used enough of it, right? And based on very high input of energy, in our case, fossil fuels. So he went on to design a whole series of remarkable inventions that are now starting to, you know, get traction and go into the mainstream. He started with fans and motors, which use about 60% of the energy, you know, the electrical energy on the planet. And has, you know, your old Apple computer, for example, had 16 fans because the thing gets so hot, you know. And so Jay has saved about 60 to 70% of the energy in that entire realm, and at the same time has created, you know, technologies that simply work much better. They've used it for boats. In fact, his work is so beautiful right there in New York the Museum of Modern Art has one of his spiral forms. And just to give you one further example, that same little impeller, rather than a propeller, which is this just aesthetically, you know, gorgeous little statue. You see these 2 million gallon water tanks in cities, and usually you see two of them. They use it to store large quantities of water, but the problem is that the water heats up and it stratifies and it starts to breed bacteria. So they have to pump the water from one tank to another, which uses a great deal of energy, and then of course they put chemicals in it, you know, to kill bacteria. So Jay put an impeller in the bottom of these tanks that uses the energy of approximately 3 light bulbs, right? And what it does is it sets up a spiral vortex that creates a pattern not unlike homeopathy throughout the water. And essentially, you don't really need to use chemicals or use it just the tiniest amount, and you no longer need to pump between the tanks. He believes now that could also be used, that same thing, for global warming, and could actually slow global warming down by about 20 years by essentially creating that spiral pattern in the atmosphere, because the same kind of thermal layering that you see in these water tanks, the greenhouse effect, in effect, is the same as the greenhouse effect in the atmosphere. So those are the implications of biomimicry.
Good. I appreciate that answer. Thank you. The Department of Defense is on record saying that climate change is or will be our greatest global and national threat. And this is far more disturbing than our belief in a war on terror being where our priorities should lie, although our politicians continue having us believe this myth. Outline for us what you envision is waiting for us in the near and far futures with global warming and climate change and other tipping points. If we continue doing with the national status quo, what we've done in the past, favoring corporate and unsustainable industry solutions over nature-based sustainable ones.
Well, you're asking all the really astute questions here. You know, for years now, the CIA has been running scenarios, and basically they've identified climate change, you know, along with the military, as being one of the top national security and global security threats. In effect, we've turned the atmosphere into a hostile power, you know, by our very, inappropriate actions for how natural systems function. And one of the paradoxes right now, because obviously the military has been the source of many, many, and is the source of many problems in the world, but in recognition of how severe this threat is now, the Department of Defense itself is about split down the middle between the more traditional view of military might outside our borders as the solution to world problems, you know, growing out of obviously the Cold War. And we actually, you know, we produce an annual conference for bioneers. That's how it originally started in 1990, and we'll have our 23rd one in mid-October out in San Rafael near San Francisco. And one of our guests, our speakers, is Colonel Mark Puck Mickleby, who just retired, went private. He was formerly the chief strategic assistant to Admiral Mike Mullen, the head of the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And what Puck developed is what he calls a grand strategy, coming on the heels of changing the Cold War mentality, that he calls a strategy of national sustainability. And what the military is looking at, for example, is, you know, how do you move 150 million people, Americans, off the coasts in the next 100 years, given rising seas and extreme storms? You take one hacker can take down the electrical grid today. I mean, serious security issue. 4 bridges go down on the Mississippi River, and New York City is hungry 48 hours later, right? So there's a pretty even split within the military now, recognizing that national security is homeland security is environmental security, and we're living with all these too big not to fail systems, these highly, you know, centralized, top down, and, you know, technologically 19th century infrastructures that are absolutely going to fail on an ongoing basis. Very, very serious security issue. So the military, Puck, you know, Colonel Mickleby went and talked to Admiral Mullen about this and a new grand strategy of sustainability. And, you know, Chairman Mullen said one word, 435, which meant put one of these projects in every single congressional district, major sustainability initiatives. The military itself is now looking to go green and has various different goals, but they're looking at, you know, becoming 50% renewable energy by 2020 or 2030, excepting combat operations. And the military, of course, has also been often the laboratory for the development of new technologies from, you know, computers to jet engines to GPS. And they recognize that the leverage they hold is huge. So as the military starts to go green and develop, you know, clean technologies, essentially, they become a market maker as well as a, you know, huge R&D force that can actually make a much greater shift much more quickly. Obviously, having just a green military is not the solution. This goes much deeper than that. However, the Pentagon budget, as you well know, is, you know, the deal breaker in the American economy in many ways. And if that funding started to shift in any measure toward clean technology, it would have a profound impact on the country. So, you know, the solutions are largely present. I mean, we already know what to do in many cases. We could save 50% of our energy just from intelligent conservation. I mean, the industrial system at large is about 94% waste, if you can wrap your mind around that. So that's a huge business opportunity as well as kind of a no-brainer in terms of a first step. And just with off-the-shelf technologies, we could make the shift off fossil fuels based on what we already know. So what we were really talking about is the political will and the economic muscle, and witness the weather, you know, not only in this country but worldwide. And this is just the beginning, you know, of how extreme it's going to get. So there's no question things are going to change. The only question is how quickly we can do this and how much suffering we can avoid as a result of doing that.
Very, very insightful comment there, Kenny. Thank you. Dr. Jill Stein, if projections are correct, we get about 2% of the presidential vote, Gary Johnson about 3%, Rock Anderson about 1%. All told, that's 6%. But behind that are 50% of the American population who will not vote, unfortunately, for them, but who are just angry at the system, mainly independent voters. I believe the time is going to come when we're just going to take a lead in doing everything necessary to save the world and build better societies on our own. In other words, just forget the federal government, state governments, local governments exist. Forget everything. Just set it aside. If they ever decide to get out of their own selfish behavior, fine. If not, we're just going on. Now, I only have two more questions, but they're segues from what you just said, because right now we have crises too numerous to mention. Just, for example, today they mentioned a suicide boom, but completely excluded any mention of psychiatry or psychiatric drugs that are a leading cause of this and people taking them. We have a new census report this week that shows poverty increased worse than what anyone thought. 100 million Americans, one-third of the population, are now at poverty level. Nothing's being done for them. Zero. Zip. There are many different epidemics of disease and illness, obesity, adult diabetes in children, an unsustainable industrial agriculture paradigm based upon monoculture and pesticides and GMOs, constant fertilizing and water waste. There are those that say the founding fabric of Western civilization and its institutions we cherish are the main culprits in the demise of the planet and humanity. And then we say, well, what could we learn? And the answer is we're not willing to learn from indigenous societies because we consider them primitive, even though they've been sustainable for millennia and would continue to be so if our Western values hadn't encroached on their cultures. So my question is this. In trying to repair society for further collapse, what can we learn from nature that applies to the way we relate to each other and create communities and new models of education and commerce and agriculture?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so much we can learn. And, you know, since 1990, since our beginnings, we've worked very closely with indigenous peoples who have, as you point out, you know, have learned quite a bit, often by trial and error, honestly. I mean, they made plenty of mistakes, too. But some of the most basic lessons are, I mean, the first one is that we are not apart from nature. We are a part of nature. And we have to expand, in a sense, the circle of compassion to understand that we're literally all relatives. You know, there's a fraction of difference in our DNA between a human being and a chimpanzee. We are literally related, as we are to the nematode worm. So it's all relatives. You know, it's one of the most basic lessons. Another one is take only what you need and give back more than you take. You know, people want a simple definition of sustainability. It means leave things better than you found it. You know, another lesson from Native peoples is gratitude. You know, the Iroquois Six Nations there in New York built probably the most advanced civilization on the planet, and they spend days on end every year, all year long, giving thanks. I asked Chief Oren Lyons, who's on our board, about this one time, and he said, you know, you have a Thanksgiving holiday. We have Thanksgiving every day. And there's a lot of science that's come out recently about gratitude that shows that the simple act of every week just making a list of five things that you feel grateful about makes you incredibly happier and kinder as a person. I mean, these are ancient, this is ancient wisdom, you know, in the most
still
profound
applies
way.
Today.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, may I say one other thing?
Sure.
I think one of the underlooked at, you know, more neglected items is when you really dial into what the underlying problem is in many ways, it's not just this mistake, systems error to think that we're separate from nature. It is actually the inequality and the extremes of wealth. The world today, the U.S. today, wealth is two times as concentrated as Imperial Rome, which was a slave and farmer society. It's an oligarchy of billionaires and ultra-rich individuals. And what's going on right now with climate change, if you really want to dial down to the bottom of it, is that there are some ultra-rich individuals who benefit the most and are the most responsible for the climate crisis. And they're probably the single biggest threat to the global climate commons today because they profit from its pollution and they're pushing government policies that promote more fossil fuels. And it ties into what you were saying about poverty. The question that I hold is, you know, do we all have Stockholm syndrome? You know, why do we identify with our captors here? We're being held hostage. You know, that, and unless we deal with inequality and the outrageous concentration of wealth, we're never going to get through the rest of it.
You actually answered my second question because I opened my show with the idea that we are a super, super monitored society, that everything all the time, 24/7, our government and corporations want to know where we're at, what we're thinking, do we pose a risk? They will tell us what diseases they think we have or believe that we have, like a social anxiety disorder, then drug us. They pathologize life. They pathologize childhood. They've corrupted our institutions. And yet the majority of Americans are ill-prepared to even know how to define the argument. Those of us who are willing to define the argument challenge them. And I do not support any of our political systems because our entire paradigm is corrupt. To me, to support the existing political system is like going to an overflowing toilet and trying to find some clean water in it. I cannot believe that intelligent people are still saying, well, you know, just give this person another chance because, you know, now their hands. These people have not been limited in what they've done. They've served the people who they really support well. They just haven't served everyone else they promised to serve, and I don't see this changing. I believe we have to have a whole new movement, but I think that will start to emerge after this election cycle. So you've touched on all the points I had. I hope that people read Dreaming the Future, Reimagining Civilization in the Age of Nature, and also listen to your radio program. It's one of our most popular, by the way. So great.
And I hope people will come to our conference in California. It's a life-changing event for a lot of people in October 19 to 21. And you can learn about it at www.bioneers.org. It's like pioneers with a B. And, you know, what we're very focused on, because you touched on this, Gary, is that there is this unseen movement that has been growing from the ground up for the past 20 years that we've been tracking it, that is now reaching critical mass and that you don't hear about in the mass media. You know, that's what you hear about on our radio series. But people are, in fact, taking power back and building from resilience from the ground up. And we have a huge program on the most inspiring and jaw-dropping models now. Huge progress is being made that's about to break through, and we've titled our conference Emergence this year because we're in the period of death and rebirth, breakdown to breakthrough, you know, and the breakthroughs are abundant, but people are not hearing about them. And the bottom line, as you said, when 50% of people don't vote, we've all got to be leaders in this time. We've all got to step up and take responsibility and do it right where we are in our homes. And so much is happening on the local and regional level. It's just mind-blowing. So it's actually, there's a lot of hope right now for me.
I'm also hopeful. I'm completely pragmatic about the status quo. I don't see anything happening. I don't see the jobs coming back. Corporations are offshoring. They're going to continue to do so. But I do see hope for those people who are willing to be honest about what they're seeing and stop believing in the illusions of our exceptionalism and look at the truth of what we've created and then decide how they can withdraw from that and reengage in a more healthy, spiritual, and holistic, natural way of living. Kenny, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I love your show.
Thank you. And you've been listening to the co-founder, or the founder and co-CEO of Bioneers, been around for a long time. One of the finest groups of visionary scholars and scientists and social leaders on the planet, as well as he's gone on to do many other things, including Hoxie, When Healing Becomes a Crime, and Dreaming the Future. Kenny Ausubel, Ausubel. And listen to him, and you can download any of his previous programs. We're coming up to the end of this program. You can continue listening because I'm going to address this issue of our national security state and ask for your feedback. You can listen by continuing over the Internet or calling 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. And we'll say goodbye to all the other land-based stations at this time, and thank you for listening. Here are some current articles from quality journals that I thought you would find of interest. I'm only going to give you just a few sentences from each. Six government surveillance programs designed to watch what you do online all the time. It was President Eisenhower who was right on point about the military-industrial complex, but I don't believe he could possibly have predicted the emergence of a massive surveillance state combining government and private sectors together. Sadly, neither President Obama nor his Republican challenger Mitt Romney has the desire or moral courage to fight the growing power and influence of the corporate security state. We're witnessing the integration of spying on two levels, the government level, federal, state, and local, and the corporate level, telecom providers, web services, and credit card companies. So if you use Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, Craigslist, and any of these popular sites, the United States security state is watching you, listening to your conversations, looking at your photographs, reading every one of your emails, without exception. And even an increasing number of federal agencies are employing sophisticated means to monitor America's use of social networking sites. The National Security Agency and the Defense Department to Department of Homeland Security and even the Internal Revenue Service. For example, the IRS uses a variety of social medias like Facebook and Google and Twitter to monitor and investigate you. The Department of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence is doing the same, as is the FBI, the Defense Department, Department of Homeland Security. They're all on board. So what does this mean? It means that you have no privacy. Unless you're having a conversation one-on-one with someone, anything and everything you do over telephone, cell phone, fax, email, someone's listening. Why? Why would they want to know what you're doing? We have lost our privacy over the last 10 years. They have multiple ways to track us. And they're getting even higher tech. There are large server farms, what are called analysis centers. They operate throughout the country. They consist of huge cloud servers that aggregate and process the data sets through innumerable applications and programs. They process data from federal agencies, local governments, and private companies. And then they sell this information or share it. So you are living in a 21st century high-tech surveillance digital alchemy brew. And yet we still live with the fog of 9/11 a decade and 1 year later, where we believe it's still right, and it's not. So my concern is, what should we do? And why haven't we spoken out? And why is the average person seemingly disconnected from any concern about this? Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Give us a call now. And while you're calling in, let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from someone who sent me this very interesting article about that the Pentagon is buying Chevy Volts to help green up the military while propping up sales of the bailed-out automaker's most politicized car. The Department of Defense is purchasing this struggling luxury electric car, which retails at $40,000. They bought them this summer as part of their goal to purchase 1,500 such, quote, green vehicles. But when you actually look at it, the Obama administration championed the production of the Volt. The company's stock has fallen about 40% since it emerged from bankruptcy, and GM and its lending arm, Ally Bank, owes $42 billion on their $57 billion bailout. So the government still has a stake in GM. So what they're saying is the Pentagon's massive car buying scheme is the latest example of the government trying to help General Motors raise its sale volumes. The General Services Administration of Las Vegas fame purchased 100 Volts in 2011 for various agencies. So they want to know, you know, if people are even considering Obama for another presidency, they have to be aware of stuff like this, and they want to know, what are your thoughts on this?
It's very simple. I believe that if the administration is going to favor select industries that it has alliances with for political gain, then it must be open to also helping just the average person. You cannot have all of the help and all the money go to one group, and that's what's happened with three of the bailouts, the quantitative easing one and two, plus the $780 billion TARP bailout, and then one that was completely secret, $16 trillion that went to 20 different banks and Wall Street firms, and never a penny to the average person, nor any pressure placed upon banks that, to drop the value of the mortgage to the value of the home, and then to forgive all late debt. Right now, if you're late on certain credit cards, debit cards, you can be charged up to 300% interest. And yet, that's $1 trillion indebtedness right now, and that's not being addressed. So if we're willing to have a government and an administration to favorably look upon an industry or a company within that industry and give no equal attention to all the other small business people and homeowners and infrastructural projects, then we should be saying shame on us for voting these people into power. Okay?
Yes.
That's what I think. I just, again, I made it very clear. I have no support within me on any level for anything within any of our federal, state, or local agencies, bureaucracies, and or politicians. I believe all of them should be thrown out of office, every single one, and start over and totally change the system, taking all money out of it and taking the lobbyists out of it. And that's what's important. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you for listening. Now, in a minute, stay tuned for Utrecht Lead. And I want to thank all of the people who have been coming on board to listen to Utrecht. The feedback has been extraordinarily favorable. It seems like Utrecht, even though gone from the airwaves for 12 years, was not forgotten. Because with no publicity, no advertising, no articles, no media, just word of mouth, she is building an incredibly supportive audience. So we'll come back in a moment with the Utrecht Lead Show. Thank you for listening. ¶¶